Grief defies categorization, especially when it falls outside society's recognized hierarchy of loss. When Russell took his own life, I found myself in an uncharted territory, mourning a friend in a world that reserves its deepest sympathy for family bereavements. Playing what I called my friend's not dead became my first instinct, creating a bubble of denial while at a literary festival in Australia. I told no one, becoming uncharacteristically social and outgoing, as if shedding my usual self allowed temporary escape from the crushing weight of reality. This wasn't simple avoidance, but a necessary buffer, the mind's way of saying, not yet. But denial, like all grief stages, offers only temporary shelter from the storm. The fragility of this protection became apparent during a book club discussion when someone shouted about suicide. Reality intruded, forcing me to confront not just Russell's death, but the nature of his choice. That night, three vivid dreams visited me: walking along abandoned train tracks to an uncrossable barrier, seeing Russell swimming happily with sea creatures, and finding my stolen jewelry returned but damaged, revealing the subconscious processing already underway. Object permanence, first learned through peekaboo, teaches children that things return after disappearing. This childhood comfort becomes cruelly ironic when facing permanent loss. Living near the restaurant where I last saw Russell became torturous. I held phantom conversations across the street and encountered him in dreams, my only chance to hear new words from him. Without a grave or ashes, I had nowhere to focus my grief, making his absence feel unreal. My grief manifested physically through unexplained panic attacks, which I initially didn't connect to Russell's suicide, having normalized my pain. When an email about my stolen jewelry arrived months after a burglary, I created a desperate equation. If I could recover these items, perhaps I could somehow recover my friend. My search for stolen jewelry became a metaphor for recovering what death had taken. An indifferent detective embodied the powerlessness that accompanies both grief and victimhood, showing how systems aren't designed for our individual losses. The tiger's eye ring returned first, but the amber necklace, more precious both financially and emotionally, became my obsession for 2 months. 6 months after the theft, it resurfaced with a Manhattan seller. Despite safety concerns, I entered the Diamond District, meeting a dealer named Dimitri and his associates. After hearing my story, Dimitri unexpectedly returned the necklace free of charge, saying, "That shouldn't have happened." His kindness brought me to tears, revealing the futility of my bargaining. The necklace couldn't bring back Russell or the past. I accepted that Russell is dead in the same way everyone who has ever died is dead, while holding on to hope that this object might maintain our connection. From 2002 to 2010, we shared a Connecticut house that became a home for wayward literary youth. Our lives merged in an idyllic blend of weekend gatherings, shared meals, and literary discussions. Russell introduced me to old Hollywood culture through documentaries and books. The house was modest, with peeling paint and Russell's collections everywhere. From my tiny yellow wallpapered room, I watched as Russell vetted my male guests, declaring them either keepers or interesting. Despite its flaws, the house represented our carefree years before real problems emerged. Not the number of years we spent up there, but the years they were. This paradise began unraveling in 2005 when Russell's partner had an emotional affair with a friend. Later, Russell befriended Hollywood royalty Brooke Hayward and helped republish her memoir. His fascination with the dead showed in his work resurrecting literary figures. Russell believed one should be on the side of the bygone and that the dead are more perfect, a mindset I now recognize as dangerous for someone who makes the dead more alive than the living. Meeting James Frey at a Los Angeles hotel 11 months before Russell's death brought back memories of our shared professional trials. Russell and I had faced the memoir scandal together, enduring hate mail with white powder and even a bloody tooth. These experiences forged a bond deeper than friendship. He was a comrade who stood by me during my darkest professional chapter. Russell's workplace struggles intensified in his final years. The first harassment complaint emerged after my departure, and he grew increasingly isolated, retreating into hibernation to avoid conflicts. His once playful teasing lost its warmth at an inopportune cultural moment, leaving him caught between being perceived as either oversensitive or callous. A colleague aptly described him as so loved, but also a wild animal in a cage at work. This professional limbo, praised for his work yet alienated from workplace culture, deepened his isolation. After his death, several publishing industry giants passed away, and their losses overshadowed his. Unlike Susan Kamel, Sunny Mehta, and Carolyn Reedy, Russell's passing went without an obituary. The anxiety of pandemic life feels like a blanket, but the sadness is a knife. In my phone, I found texts from 2018 where Russell and I made a pact about suicide. "Let's make a deal. No killing yourself without my approval first. I'll do the same," he wrote. "I'll have to live just to spite you," I replied. "Right back at you. Guess we're both going to live forever." The exchange now carries a painful irony, showing how even direct conversations about suicide couldn't prevent his death. During lockdown, I sought refuge in Grand Central Terminal, finding it eerily empty. The backward-painted ceiling, with west as east and east as west, became a metaphor for distorted reality. On an empty train, I imagined filling seats with people from my past, until Russell sat beside me, where I confessed trying to blend his death with others like feeding a dog its medicine in peanut butter. Walter DeMaria's art installation, The Vertical Earth Kilometer, reaches down unanswered, like my broken gold chain crying out for its missing half, reminiscent of glass broken at Jewish weddings, symbolizing a marriage's hoped-for permanence. This mirrors grief itself, reaching into unseen depths without guarantee of response. It exists in perpetual questioning, searching without finding. Most things remain unresolved. I still wonder where everything I loved has gone. To live the expansive life Russell wanted, I must learn to be on the side of the living while accepting our divergent paths. Choosing life, despite my connection to someone who chose death, marks a crucial step in my grief journey. My grief, though unruly, shares the universal logic of all who've experienced it. I sometimes let it spread through my space, but since I cannot call Russell home, I've made grief my home instead. It returns to me, zipping itself to my edges, making a life with me, like an outline of a woman whose time has not yet come, resting on my chest, unaware of its power.